Well, it's good to be back at the Salk Institute. I started here in San Diego when I came 27 years ago. One could hardly imagine a more historically appropriate site at which to look at RNA and reprogramming, because 40 years ago here at the Salk Institute, Howard Temin, David Baltimore, and Renato Del Becco showed that the dogma of DNA to RNA to protein had exceptions. And with those retrovirus discoveries, the world of inducible pluripotent stem cells really had its origins. Serving on the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee gives me the opportunity to see the applications that have been reviewed by our grants working group. And what is continually renewing to me is the inspiring creativity of our applicants in being able to take that knowledge and do something good for the people of California and hopefully for the world. So I'm sure this morning we'll have more creativity in this session on reprogramming. And our first speaker is Kristen Baldwin from the Scripps Research Institute. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Cell Biology. She spoke to us last year on what was then her favorite topic, the olfactory system, and since then has made some inspiring discoveries. Kristen.
Okay. Well, thank you for letting me speak to you 2 years in a row. I apologize for those of you who have had to sit through both presentations. And I'll dispense with the jokes, too, in the interest of time, and because I am not funny. So today I'm going to talk to you about reprogramming, and not so much about RNA, except for at the very end, because I don't know that much about RNA. I really don't know that much about reprogramming. But what you're looking at here is a picture from Waddington's early studies of how cells become differentiated cell types from undifferentiated cell types. And he made a model which would say that an undifferentiated cell is falling down a hill into a number of valleys where it can become a different kind of differentiated cell, and then it will stay there. The reason he made this model is one of the central mysteries of development, which is that from the embryo at fertilization, cells have a property called totipotency. That is, they can make all of the cell types in the body. And as development proceeds, this property is maintained until about here. And then in the blastocyst, cells in the inner cell mass become somewhat specialized and become what's called pluripotent, where they can make all these cell types, but they cannot make the extra embryonic tissues. And this property, this process, for whatever reason in animals, seems to always go in one direction. And it's for this reason that, let's see if I can get this together, that embryonic stem cells were such an exciting invention. These are cells that are taken from the inner cell mass of the blastocyst that can be propagated in a dish and maintain pluripotency, the property to generate all of these cell types. And so that's the way things stood. And the promise of embryonic stem cells was that you could use them to make these cell types in a dish and perhaps for replacement parts for people. And so in mammals, it was thought that you could not reverse this process. And this is a quote from Nabokov. Nobody can imagine in physical terms the act of reversing the order of time. But it turns out that you can imagine this. And one of my favorite authors, Martin Amis, did in fact imagine this in his book, Time's Arrow, where he wrote a book backwards in time from a person, Dr. Todd T. Friendly, who lived backwards until he found out that he was actually a doctor involved in Auschwitz and the Holocaust. And this is a kind of frightening story, but it shows that when you reverse differentiation, you also reverse some of the ethical issues that are involved in actions. And so, in 1998, Dolly the sheep first was cloned, and then mice were cloned using a process called somatic cell nuclear transfer. And this was the first demonstration in mammals that you could reverse differentiation's arrow, and that you could take a differentiated cell and push it back in time to become something like an embryonic stem cell. And so this process is something that I've done in my lab, cloning from neurons, which I spoke about last year. It's very difficult. So what you have to do is you have to take an egg, and this is an egg. You have to remove its DNA, which we're about to do here. And this takes a lot of skill, and usually a student who plays a lot of video games. And then you have to take a differentiated cell and pull it into a pipette, get its nucleus, and then inject its nucleus into this egg. And when you do this, you can see this nucleus coming in. One, two, three. When you do this, something happens in the egg to reprogram this nucleus to take all of the marks of differentiation off of that DNA and replace them with the marks that look a lot like the marks in the early fertilized zygote. And so when I was doing this work with Kevin Egan to clone from neurons, we sat in the basement of the Whitehead for many, many, many hours doing this. Cloning is only successful about 1 in 100 times if you're very good. And we were thinking to ourselves, there must be a better way. This is so inefficient, and we're in the dark, and it's kind of hot. And so how could you do this? And we brainstormed a lot, as did I think the entire field. We did not come up with the answer, but Shinya Yamanaka did in this landmark experiment that I think you've all heard about. What he did is took genes that were in embryonic stem cells, he put them in viruses, he threw them on differentiated cells from skin, fibroblasts, and he turned those fibroblasts in about 2 weeks into things that remarkably looked like embryonic stem cell colonies. So this was just unbelievable that you could change a differentiated cell back to an embryonic stem cell just by throwing viruses on and watching. And so when we saw that, we got interested in this process. Now, the promise of these cells has probably been covered by others in this day and will be, but the idea is that with induced pluripotent stem cells, you can do what embryonic stem cells can do, but you can also do that in a patient-specific way. You could make stem cells from every person that would be matched to themselves. And you could also do it with high efficiency and make lines that had different properties. Finally, because you can make these from humans, you should be able to make in vitro models of disease, and I think you've already heard something about that. So, briefly, what's the state of the art in iPS cells? Well, we know that multiple cell types can make iPS cells. The first cells were mouse fibroblasts, then human fibroblasts using different combinations of genes, then many other cell types have now been reprogrammed. So this is a robust process. The second thing to know is that you can reprogram using different combination of genes. There are many ways to get to what looks like an embryonic stem cell, an iPS cell. You can take away c-MYC, you can add OCT4 and SOX2 simply only to neural stem cells, or OCT4 alone. I apologize to all the people who've done this work for not mentioning you in the interest of time. You can replace, you can augment reprogramming with small molecules, and you can replace some of the factors with other small molecules. Finally, the first iPS cells were made using an integration process with lentiviruses or retroviruses, but you don't need those. You can actually reprogram without viruses using integration and removal of DNA or with no integration whatsoever. And so all of these different mechanisms to make things that look like iPS cells are very exciting. And so what is going on in the field? What are the important questions? Well, one important question is, what's the best way to generate iPS cells to make models and for potential human use? The second question is, can iPS cells actually generate all the cell types that you want? Are they the same as ES cells or as good as embryonic stem cells or not? Third, will iPS-derived cells be stable and functional? And will they last as long as cells in your body? And fourth, will iPS cells and the derived cells from them be safe? Will they turn into tumors? Will something bad happen? So we wanted to answer some of these questions. And the way that you can look at iPS cells in mice to try to get at this is you can actually incorporate them into an entire animal. And one way to do that is to make a chimeric animal where you mix iPS cells in a blastocyst with normal cells, and you get an animal that has mixed tissues. And you can evaluate the tissues that come from your iPS cells for certain properties. A second way is to generate mice in a method called tetraploid complementation, where you use a blastocyst that has been electrically fused so it cannot contribute to the mouse. And what you do is you put your pluripotent cells in. And in this case, if and only if these cells are completely pluripotent and can generate all the necessary cell types in the animal, that's the only time you'll get a live born mouse. So what has happened with iPS cells with these assays? Well, it turns out the first generation of iPS cells that were made generated a lot of cell types in the dish, but couldn't make chimeric animals. The second generations of iPS cells made by many labs, including the Janisch lab and Hochleitner lab and Yamanaka lab, generate chimeric mice, and you can tell they're chimeric because they have different colors of fur. But what they could not do is generate live born mice in tetraploid complementation assays. And many labs tried this, and we didn't understand why this was not working. And so this is in contrast to embryonic stem cells and also embryonic stem cells derived by cloning. So reprogrammed cells, we knew, could be used to make entire mice in this assay, and we had done that with reprogrammed cells from neurons. So what are the reasons why that might be the case? Well, what we know is that E14, when all of the other iPS-derived mice made with tetraploid complementation stopped developing, there are a lot of cell types that are missing. There are no glia in the brain. Many neurons haven't been properly generated. They're certainly not well wired. Many synapses aren't formed. Bone marrow is incomplete. The aorta is not formed. The urethra is not formed. So a lot of cell types we didn't know about if they could be made functionally. Our experiments we talked about last year, we were interested eventually in reprogramming neurons, and we wanted to make mice where we could actually get an entire animal with very rare neural cell types that we could reprogram. And so we decided to go ahead and try to make slightly better iPS cells using everybody else's work as the basis for our experiments. And so what we did is we said a couple of things might be going on. First of all, it may be that when you make these cells and you have viruses, when you're making the animal, the viruses come back on and mess things up. And so we'll try to make a very quiet system. So we used a drug-activatable transcription factor that can come over and bind here to these promoters and turn on the reprogramming factors. This is a different version than other people have used, and it causes very high expression, and these promoters also are very quiet after you turn off the drug. The second thing we did is a genetic marking strategy just to validate that the cells we made and the mice we made were all from our animal. And in this case, all you need to know is that if they're from our animal, they'll be blue, and if they're not, they won't be. And so we used an extended reprogramming protocol with the four canonical Yamanaka factors. We also added valproic acid because that's been reported to do two things: to enhance reprogramming efficiency and also select against poorly reprogrammed cells. And so we added virus, we waited a while, we added the drug to start the reprogramming, we added valproic acid, we saw colonies coming up quite soon in 4 or 5 days from adding the reprogramming. We then continued reprogramming for quite some time, for another 20 days or so. And then we removed the doxycycline, that removes the external factors, and we waited to see which colonies would stay looking like embryonic stem cells and which would not. We picked those which were stable. We ranked them according to some criteria, which include how much they looked like embryonic stem cells, what they stained with embryonic stem cell markers, their karyotype, and then we tested them in traditional chimeric mouse assays. And we were gratified to see that several of our lines, in fact, all of our lines, were able to generate mice that seemed to be almost 100% derived from our iPS cells by coat color. And so we said, let's go ahead and do a tetraploid complementation assay and see if these will work to make mice. And so we did this assay with the help of our mouse genetics core at Scripps, where Sergey Kuprianov, who's the director, is one of the first people to do tetraploid complementation. And this is a tricky procedure. So Alberto Rodriguez, who's an orphan from Mexico who came up and learned to do this procedure, really did most of the work. And he's amazing. So he can do a lot of injections in a day. We sacked our first pregnant mother at E17, and we found pups. We were very excited. We went further and started generating animals, and we were able to actually generate a lot of mice in this assay derived entirely from the iPS cells that we generated. So these mice are fertile and reasonably normal. We could validate that they were actually derived from our cells using staining for blue, using PCR assays for the contribution of the donor, where we can show that down to 0.1 to 0.01%, we have no contribution. And we were able to establish four lines so far that make mice that are live born, and some with very high efficiency, 13, 10% of the time, this line makes mice. And we're continuing these experiments. So this is a very high efficiency. This is like what you get with an embryonic stem cell line that's good at this. And so our animals also, because they have a drug-inducible reprogramming strategy, allow us actually to take their tissues, such as fibroblasts, and instead of reprogramming with viruses, we can add doxycycline and basically get iPS cell lines again. And so We called this guy Fibonacci because it's a way of propagating an animal without any reproduction, and so we can make more and more and more animals, presumably with this approach, which will also let us test the reprogrammability of these other tissues. So what do we want to do with these mice? Why are they useful? Well, we think that we can use them to understand something about the stability of the cells in all different tissues. And so we're looking at the neurologic, potential neurologic abnormalities and metabolic abnormalities, because those are expected to be affected by imprinting and epigenetic changes that you heard about. Also, we'd really like to know, what is the tumor susceptibility of these mice and other mice that are derived using other reprogramming methods, and are there tumors formed? And so far, we've not observed any, which is good news. So it may be that the stable, quiet integration strategy is useful. So finally, I told you that you can make iPS cells with different developmental potentials, and we'd like to understand what causes that. And so there are several hypotheses. One is that in every reprogramming experiment, there are a few rare colonies that can do this, and we just got lucky. A second is this inducible system and quietly quieting down the genes in differentiated tissues. And a third is that this longer extended reprogramming may produce iPS cells that have a really different metastable state and increased potency compared to other lines. So to distinguish between those, I should mention that two other groups also made mice at the same time that we did from iPS cells, and this group, which had reasonable efficiency, used retroviruses, not the inducible system. So we think it's not required to have a quiet system for this. We also think the fact that four of four lines that we tested first generate mice means that it's not rare, at least not in our dish. So what about the third option? Can we look at gene expression patterns in our iPS cells versus iPS cells that don't make mice and observe anything? So these are a bunch of iPS versus ES gene expression profiles, and these are the Pearson correlations. So these are three pretty good lines, and a fourth that's good. These are two lines that spontaneously differentiate. And here's our line. It has a Pearson correlation quite similar to these lines, not better. So we wanted to know, are there specific genes that are different in our cell line and that might be a signature of a good iPS cell, something we could use to apply to human iPS derivation and evaluate different techniques for making the cells? So what we did is we took these cells that are good, and we got a list of all the genes in which they were significantly different from embryonic stem cells. And so there were 190 genes where those cells, all four, were up, and 122 where they were down, and that's a significant difference. Then we said, let's look at our iPS cells compared to those. And so these are the set of genes that are different in our iPS cells compared to these. And we said, okay, we know they're significantly different. What are they doing? Are they becoming more like embryonic stem cells, or are they becoming less like embryonic stem cells? And so this is a plot of those data. So gray is the old iPS over ES. So some of them are actually way up here at 14-fold change, but that's 5-fold change, 4-fold, and so on, arranged in order. And then this is our line compared to ES. And what we find is that 80% of our of these genes in our line are indistinguishable from embryonic stem cells in their level of expression, and that the remainder of them tend to go towards embryonic stem cells. And so we found a similar result in those which are downregulated, 80% again. And these are the final data. I'll wrap it up. So we think that our new protocol may produce iPS cells that are really different from the previous cells, and that those genes may be a candidate set of genes to use for picking out good iPS cells in the future. And so back to the first slide, which is that when you take a different undifferentiated cell and let it differentiate into stable differentiated cell types, we know that they kind of get stuck there. If you invert this process and reverse differentiation's arrow, you can push these differentiated cells back into this well, but this well may not be the way that it was drawn. This well may be multiple, so this thing may look like different valleys and peaks on this end as well. And so we'd like to understand what those are and what's regulating those. So finally, I'd just like to, questions that remain: are fully reprogrammed cells such as ours less tumor prone? Will these cells be better at generating particular cell types? And can we identify analogs of this version 3 iPS cell in human experiments? And will those be more useful? So Thank you for your time, and I'd like to thank the people who did the work, which are my postdoc Mike Boland, Kit Naser, Jen Hazen, two graduate students. The gene expression work was done by Brett Fields, and the Mouse Genetics Core was invaluable to us in doing all of the embryology. Okay, thanks.
Roger, do you want to have questions now, or should we wait for the panel discussion?
Questions now, if you want.
All right, let's take urgent questions
two
now, because we're going to have
urgent
discussion
questions
later, if we can get through in time.
Do you want to think about it and do it in the panel later?
There's one over there.
Yeah, have you noticed any sort of like large scale or gross differences in your iPS version 3 mice in terms of lifespan? Do they susceptibility to any kind of disease or anything?
Well, they're only 6 months old right now, and we don't have that many because most of them sacrifice their lives for the paper. But we are generating a lot more, and we hope to find out. But they, there's not been anything obvious so far.